You're listening to Kids These Days. On Kids These Days, we're talking about raising Alaska's future today. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Each week, we take on a different topic that relates to youth and family life in South Central Alaska. And today, we have a very special guest here to share what she knows and to answer your questions. We'll be in the studio today talking with Dr. Patricia Kuhl of the University of Washington's iLabs. Stay tuned for that interview. On Kids These Days today, we're exploring how the smallest humans learn language and develop their brains. Later in the program, Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez will talk with two educators about preserving Alaska Native languages. But first up, this reporting about a local resource. Delayed speech is just one sign that a child may not be developing normally. There are all kinds of reasons a parent might worry whether a child is developing like other children of the same age. Luckily, there's somewhere to turn to find out and get help if you do need it. There are 18 infant learning centers across the state of Alaska designed to serve families with children ages 0 to 3 years old with developmental delays and disabilities. Jessica Cochran visited one that serves the Anchorage area, Program for Infants and Children, or PIC.
In a big storage room at PIC's Midtown offices, there are shelves full of toys and cupboards of equipment. Along the wall, different types of toddler-sized walkers are lined up next to specialized chairs designed to help kids be successful eaters.
Different toothbrushes that would help kids kind of feel sensation in their mouth that is not scary.
PIC's executive director, Amy Simpson, pulls out a bin full of toothbrushes.
You know, some kids, if they have had difficulty eating and everything that went in their mouth kind of was scary and they choked, that they may be very defensive about what we put in their mouth. And so we try to do things that are really appropriate for a child's age.
This equipment can all be lent out to families to use at home with their kids. In fact, most of what PIC does happens at home, starting with the first assessment when a child is referred for services.
That's where kids are most comfortable. That's where they are through the majority of their day. Little kids don't really, we don't see a good representation and of their skills. If they're going into something that looks like a doctor's office and they're afraid they're going to get poked with a needle.
Infants and toddlers might be referred by a doctor or hospital, by the Office of Children's Services, child care providers, or just by parents who are worried. Simpson says some families in Alaska don't have a lot of support nearby, and it's easy to become anxious. PIC gets about 900 referrals a year. Within 45 days, the agency sends at least two professionals to assess the child.
We evaluate gross and fine motor skills, so kind of walking, moving, and then how kids use their hands. We evaluate communication skills, so what they understand of language and then what they're able to tell us. We evaluate their cognitive skills, so kind of their early problem-solving skills, kind of how they kind of maneuver through their world, and that can be really very early on.
They also look at self-help skills like eating or getting dressed and how kids are connecting emotionally with their caregivers and peers. If a child is enrolled for services with PIC, a whole team will work with the family, speech pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, and early childhood specialists are all on staff. No one is turned away if they can't pay. PIC can bill Medicaid or insurance for some services, and there's a sliding fee scale for whatever isn't covered. Simpson emphasizes that the goal is to support the whole family, not to work only with the child.
Parents are part of the team. Parents are the expert on their child, and we're there to support parents and to give parents information so that parents can make decisions for their children.
Basically, they would kind of coach you to look, you know, what to look for, and then just encourage you that your child was making progress, even if it was slow or even if you didn't know really if you thought they were ever going to master a certain skill.
Kama Tate Gregory's family started working with PIC shortly after her son was born. He had hydrocephalus and has paralysis on one side.
Just having someone who wasn't judging you also, I think, is important. And I had great, great therapists from PIC, so I never felt like there was more I should be doing as a mom. And, you know, that's a challenge when you have a child that needs a little extra help, that you think there's always something you should or could be doing. And so I think them teaching us just how to make, you know, make it work with where they are, with where your child is developmentally, that was very, very helpful.
Gregory is thankful her son got services so early. She sees other kids and parents struggling to figure out what they need and trying to play catch-up on skills. Her son has graduated from speech therapy, the first time his therapist had ever seen that. And Gregory doesn't think it would have been possible if he hadn't started so early. She describes programs for infants and children as a kind of cocoon, providing coordinated services, comfort, and support, and preparing her and her son for the years to come. I'm Jessica Cochran.
I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days. Dr. Patricia Kuhl is an expert on early learning and is known internationally for her research on early language and brain development and for studies that demonstrate how young children learn. She is the Bezos Family Foundation Endowed Chair for Early Childhood Learning, the co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, that's iLabs, at the University of Washington. She's also a professor there and the director of the National Science Foundation Science of Learning Center called the Life Center. Welcome, Dr. Kuhl, and thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's really an honor for us to have you here on Kids These Days. And maybe a good place for me to start is to ask you to explain a little bit about how infants do crack the speech code. That's the topic of one of your presentations.
Well, we've been learning over the past 20 years how the human mind, and especially the very young mind, learns. We're interested in learning over the lifespan, and one of the things that the behavioral studies have shown is that children learn more in the first 5 years of life than they will ever learn in any other five-year period in their entire lifetimes. So we've been trying to understand how it is they learn, when they learn, and what they learn. And we're seeing that there are particular temporal windows of opportunity when information from the environment is very effective in changing the brain mechanisms underlying learning. And language is such a fantastic example, and we believe that what we're learning about language won't be limited just to language, but may apply to other aspects of development, like cognitive development or social-emotional development. And what we've discovered is that children learn in the first 7 years a language or two or three or even four, if you're growing up in Europe, in an incredible way that's different than how we do it. And in fact, what we've shown quite effectively is after the age of seven, every 2 years after the age of seven, you learn less well if you're exposed to a second language. And beyond puberty, and puberty is a real benchmark with regard to the brain, you really don't learn it very well at all.
Wow.
So it's a very big puzzle to understand, how do kids do it? And what's the magic they're putting to work that you're in their brains that your brain and my brain can't seem to accomplish?
So do you have any quick answers then that you can share with us? How are kids doing that? Especially, you know, it seems like you've said some numbers here, like early infants or young infants, and then you said something about age seven and then teenagers and so on. So what are you learning about how they're doing that at those different stages?
Well, what we're showing is that in the first year of life, for example, before a baby says their first word, so you haven't heard any words come out of the mouth of this child. And yet the research is showing that the babies are listening really carefully to how it is that all the adults around them are talking. And what they're doing seems to be of two different natures. One of the things that they do is highly computational. It's as though they've got a computer up there, and that's not really a surprise. Our brains are massive devices, bigger and more complex than the world's supercomputers. But it's amazing to imagine and demonstrate in the laboratory that babies are taking statistics on the sounds they hear. They're really affected by the frequency with which there are sounds in a language like English as opposed to Japanese or French. And their brains take a special attention to the sounds that occur most frequently. And so who would have thought that babies are cognizant of the numbers of times that sounds come by? And we can, in fact, change what they perceive by changing the relationship of the frequencies of the number of the sounds that they hear. So let me go a little bit further and say what we can see in the first 6 months of life with regard to language is that babies, unlike us, can hear the distinctions between all the sounds used to distinguish words in all languages of the world. So whether you're giving them sounds used in Japanese or Tagalog or French or German or Urdu, the babies can hear those distinctions. They're minute acoustic differences. But if you test any adult on the planet with a language that they didn't hear when they were young, those differences are virtually impossible to hear, even with training. And so part of it, of what's going on when they're first exposed in that first year, is changing from that citizen of the world, that's my name for them, that as they were born, citizens of the world with regard to language, into the dedicated listeners, the culture-bound individuals that you and I are. And that change happens amazingly early in development. So up to 6 months of age, they are citizens of the world. But between 6 months and 12 months prior to the occurrence of first words, they completely change. They decline in the ability to hear the distinctions that aren't used in their language, and they are rapidly getting better at the ones that are used. So if you test Japanese and American babies, we went to Tokyo, tested the Tokyo babies and the Seattle babies on ra versus la. Can they hear that change? Ra, 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 la, la, la. Can they hear that change? They can all hear it equally well, the Japanese babies and the American babies, at 6 to 8 months. By 10 to 12 months, only the American kids can hear that distinction. And
wow.
The Japanese kids can no longer. And what's interesting is they're both preparing. Both sets of babies are preparing exactly, correctly, for their language. Japanese babies don't want to listen to the difference between R and L. It doesn't make a whit of difference to their language.
And so when you say that you are in an environment where you're testing an infant who's not yet 6 months or 8 months of age, and you can tell that they can hear or not hear the difference between la and ra, how in the world are you finding that out?
Okay, so that itself is something that takes you a long time to figure out. How are we going to measure these babies? So we have behavioral and brain measures. So the behavioral measure is one that we invented at the University of Washington. Baby sits on a mom's or a dad's lap, and we're entertaining the baby on the right with toys. So the babies are just glued to these little toys that we're waving, and they're silent toys, so they're not making any noise. And at the same time, to the baby's left, there's a loudspeaker. And the loudspeaker is, you know, emitting a sound, rah, rah, rah. And every once in a while, it's going to change to something else, another syllable. On top of the loudspeaker, there's a black box, and it's dark inside, so babies have no clue that there's something there. What we train them to do is, as soon as the sound changes from ra to anything else, ra to la, for example, the babies will be rewarded for orienting towards the sound change, which they do naturally. When they hear it change, they'll tend to look and has something happened over there. They'll look at it. And then the black box on top of the loudspeaker lights up, and inside there's a dancing bear or a dog jumping up and down, clapping cymbals, you know, various animals that activate and do things that are fascinating to a six-monther, right? So what we do is test them with the sounds of many languages, and we showed that between 6 and 8 months of age, they're just every baby from every country is equally good on every sound from every language.
Wow.
They're just universalists.
Yeah.
And the moms and dads sitting behind them are clueless to the distinctions that we're testing. We put earphones on them so they can't influence the babies, but when we test them afterwards, they have no clue. So then at 10 to 12 months of age, those very same babies, a whole world of change has happened in their brain, and they start to behave like the parents. The American babies can't hear the Chinese sounds. They can't hear those distinctions they heard at 6 months, and the Japanese babies can't hear the sound changes in the Americans' language, you know, those phonetic units that are important to changing the meanings of words. So there's a sea change going on in the baby brain between 8 months and 10 months, and that sea change is this computational ability I just described. And something we've just learned about quite recently, the computational findings we had in the 90s, a whole decade from all laboratories, including my own, showing that the babies are behaving like little computers, counting up the sounds, and that you could influence them by the frequencies of things. But in the 2003, we discovered that this computational brain is controlled by another part of the brain that's more socially oriented. So we discovered again in experiments that at, for example, 9 months, during what we think is this critical sensitive period to the development of early language skills, we exposed babies for the first time to a brand new language. And we used either Mandarin Chinese or Spanish. And my graduate students, I had six of them whose native language was Mandarin Chinese. I had another group whose native language included Spanish. And so those graduate students would play with the babies for 12 sessions between the age of 9 months and 10 months. And the kids would come into the laboratory and ones and twos and threes, and they'd sit on the floor with these graduate students. It was like having relatives visit you, move into your house, you know, when you were 9 months, and they'd play with you three times a week. And by the end of a month, you'd have been played with, bathed in a new language 12 times. Really less than 5 hours of experience.
Less than 5 hours?
Less than five, because these were 25-minute sessions.
Oh, my gosh, okay.
So we test them before and after. And before the exposure, they cannot hear the Chinese Mandarin distinctions or the Spanish distinctions. And after the exposure, they're as good as the kids in the foreign country. You give the brain the right information at the right time, and it absorbs it like a sponge. So, but only, and here's the punchline, only under social conditions. So if you expose the kids to that same information over a beautiful DVD, we recorded the sessions and made these gorgeous professional films, and the kids came in, same dosage, same time, same number, same amount of, you know, everything.
It sounds like it was even the same experience.
It was the same experience.
But on video.
On video. Or on a kind of akin to an audio-only exposure. So one group of 32 babies had the DVDs. Another group of 32 babies heard it only as an auditory signal, like you were getting an audio tape, and they were watching a teddy bear on the screen. Okay, so we want to know, what have we done to their brains under these conditions? So the live exposure is phenomenal learning, produces phenomenal learning, equal to the kids in the foreign country. The TV exposure and the audio exposure produce nothing, absolutely no learning whatsoever. Even though the babies in the TV condition are glued to that television set, you'd swear for all the world that those kids are learning because they appear to be mesmerized by the screen.
Wow.
The graduate student said, oh, those DVDs are so good, these kids are going to learn like crazy. And look at them stare at it. They love it. I mean, they'd go up to the television and touch it. One of the babies would try to kiss Lotus, who was one of the Mandarin speakers. I mean, they tried to pick the toys from the television set. It's as though it was the real thing. But the measures afterwards, the head turn test that I just described, would demonstrate that they'd learned absolutely nothing about the language.
And so that means there's something about that tangible
eye
contact,
that social
touch interaction experience.
Well, so that's again, the puzzle now. Answers to a scientist always produce new puzzles. So the new puzzle that we're trying to crack is what's going on in the live social. What's happening? So the biologists will say, well, it's pheromones. You know, it has to do with the scent that we as humans, we know we're next to one another. And, that, you know, there's something to it. The tangibleness, like you said, of being next to another human being, to watch their faces, to see their eyes, to watch the nodding and agreement that really feeds us as human beings in social interaction. Is it that kind of information? Is it sort of an arousal, attention that human beings produce in the presence of one another? There's all kinds of subtle things we do. And when the tutors were naming new things and introducing new toys to the playing on the floor, they would be looking at the toys they were talking about, of course. And the kids are very good about that age at doing what humans, only humans do, which is to eye gaze follow. If I look up suddenly, people I'm looking at would also look up because they are expecting that I'm throwing a spotlight on something interesting up there.
And humans kind of do that their whole lives, right? Like I was just
exactly.
In an elevator earlier today. When I looked up to see it was floor three, I could feel
everybody
else in
looking
the elevator
up.
Do the same thing.
So we are training one another because we're so socially tuned to each other. And it looks like the babies are too. So that's one potential explanation. But we're not sure yet what it really is. We're trying to learn through experiments what constitutes a social being to a baby. You know, they play with toys and imaginary things, robots. You know, there's all kinds of thoughts that we have about experiments that could be done to explore what it takes to have a baby imagine that the thing in front of them is real. And maybe that's what it takes.
Yeah. So has your research affected the way that you view how, I'll just use our country, for example,
sure.
how our country as a culture treats its youngest people?
Yeah, well, I think we could do a whole lot better. We pay more for people to park our cars than we do to take care of our children, for example. I don't think the country is doing the job that it should be doing in assisting children. And I think that the support needs to go to families. If you believe everything I've said, you understand that the most important group of people outside the baby are the frontline people who are in front of those babies, because the babies are absorbing what those frontline people do in front of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we ought to be applauding and paying attention to the needs of parents who are going through, you know, all of us admit that raising children has got to be one of the most exhausting things we do in our lives. And yet most of us would say it's one of the most extraordinary and pleasurable and wonderful things that we do. And so I think what cultures owe the parents is a little bit of support, both emotional, social, and financial, to bring that event about, because we're all invested in the lives of our children. They're tomorrow's workforce. They're the future of the nation. They're the legacy that all of us hope to leave long beyond the time that we can influence the world. So we should be, if we value that resource, we ought to be thinking really hard and be in conversations a great deal of the time about what we should be doing to help parents do this most important job.
I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to Kids These Days. We're in the studio today with Dr. Patricia Kuhl. She works with the University of Washington in various capacities. And Patricia, you were just talking a little bit about how children and parents operate as a family.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty obvious, but that they're really linked in so many ways. And parents can sometimes, the term parents can sometimes be applied more broadly than maybe in the past has been applied. We're talking about mothers
sure.
and fathers and aunties and uncles and
right.
grandparents and caretakers and legal guardians and even teachers in some cases and other mentors and family members. And this show is about families and youth and family issues. And we have some questions that we've collected from our mm-hmm. listening community, and there are a few that are about parenting, so I think now is a great time to take that first one. We have a question from Bonnie, and Bonnie called in from Anchorage.
Hi, this is Bonnie Headley from Anchorage, and my question for Dr. Kuhl is, what is the relative value of listening to children, talking to children, conversing with children, as opposed to testing children? We live in a time where, you know, we're really kind of trying to push our kids to grow up faster and to talk faster and to read earlier, and I'm wondering if there's any research that shows that letting kids just kind of grow at their own pace might be healthier for them than pushing them to learn faster. So that's my question. Thanks. Bye.
Well, that's a wonderful question, Bonnie. I couldn't agree with you more. We should not be pushing kids to do things at times when their biology doesn't allow them to do it. Let me give you an example. You can't show flashcards with words on them to nine-monthers and expect them to learn words. Their brains are not capable of learning words at that time. So one of the things that the science is demonstrating to us is when these windows of opportunity open in development for particular kinds of activities. And parents don't really need to consult textbooks to know that. I think that they have great intuitions if they're really watching and interacting with babies, and interacting is the key word. They can really tell what kids gravitate towards. And I can tell you that the science has demonstrated, and I think most parents know, that there's no better stimulus in the world for a young child than the face of an adult interacting with that child, smiling and happy and playing with that child. There are no more fetching items in the world than to listen to an adult talking to them, to play interactively with things that are common, not fancy toys, not DVDs, but things in the kitchen, you know, pots and pans. So you asked whether talking to them, reading to them, or listening to them, you know, in interaction, all those things are important. A sign of a brain's tendency or readiness to learn can be the child kind of cooing back or talking back. So it's good when what you do with babies, playing with them, smiling at them, elicits something from them, even if that's just a coo at, you know, 12 weeks, or a ba 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 at 7 months, you know, canonical babbling, or first words at 1 year. That signals a readiness for the brain to engage and learn. So I think both talking to them and listening to them is really, really important. I also am a great fan of reading to kids. I think it's one of the things that levels the playing field. Not all kids can see the sights of the world. I grew up in a very poor family, but my parents believed in education, and my father had books around all the time, and he was always reading to us and encouraging us to read as we grew up. And I think the world of books for me opened up a world of imagination that, you know, levels the playing field, because those black lines on a white page you learn can take you to worlds that you can't otherwise get to. So I would tell parents to, even if the kids are 6 months and chewing on the book, I would set up the habit of reading to your child for brief periods every day. It will become a lifelong love of theirs and yours.
And I'll paraphrase, there's a related question that came from a listener named Travis, and he was wondering, he's got a 2-year-old, he says, who's interested in reading already, because they read books every day and so forth, but he's a little concerned about doing that too early. Is there such a thing as a child learning to read too early?
I think if you're pushing a child to read, there can be such a thing as trying to make the child behave as though they're reading. Typically, when a 2-year-old will grab a book, especially when they're used to you reading a book, you know, the kids have memorized the books. They're so clever. And if you change a line in a book, they know it right away, call you on it. So when a 2-year-old grabs a book and starts talking and reading some of the lines, I think what they're doing is bringing back from memory what it is that they heard you read. That's a wonderful thing. It's getting them into the habit of doing what they've seen the adults do, which is a wonderful thing. So I wouldn't worry about getting them to do that too early. I would just let it happen naturally. Kids will begin to recognize letters and shape forms, and they'll be curious about it. They'll ask you about it. Let them lead the way, and then I don't think you can go wrong.
I'd like to pick up on something you said that's related about your experience with books and those books transporting you to places that your imagination could dream up and to help with a creative process. And it's related to your research. As I've looked at some of the research and tests and projects and so forth that you've been involved with in your career, I had this persistent question in my own mind, which was, where did Dr. Kuhl come up with the idea for this research in the first place? Like, where did the idea come from to test infants for this kind of capacity? Could you maybe share?
It's an interesting thing. I think that what I would say is that you follow a curiosity that you have, and you give yourself time to relax enough so that ideas come to you. So that, you know, that's a sort of sequence of things. I think, first of all kids are born curious. We have an innate curiosity about things. That's why kids' favorite question at the age of 2 is, what's that? What's that? Why? Parents literally lose their minds.
My 2-year-old says, what's that for do?
Yeah, what's that for do? That's a wonderful phrase. Give me the whole shebang. They want everything with regard to this thing. So they're innately curious, and we should be careful not to turn that off, not to channel them so strongly towards test-taking. Bonnie, I think, mentioned test-taking. You know, you can turn kids off by programming them to behave as though only this is interesting, only the correct answer is interesting. I think in my family, we were very, very curious. There were 5 kids. we were curious about everything. And my father encouraged us, my mother too, but more my father encouraged us to try to figure things out. Why does it work that way? Why are people like this? Why do objects work in this way? Why do you behave in this way? It's a sort of natural curiosity that I think all kids have. When that's encouraged and you start bumping into problems, if you're given enough time to just let things happen, take enough walks, get out into the beautiful mountains here, there are times when I really think the brain needs to make free connections, and it does so in a very healthy way and an unusual way when you're relaxing. When you're walking on the beach, when you're walking in the mountains, when you're not focused on it, ideas will occur to you. And that's what's happened to me most of the time.
I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days. We'll be back with more from Dr. Patricia Kuhl about infants and how they learn language and develop their brains during their earliest years. That's after this break. Next time on Kids These Days, Sarah Sledge from Anchorage United for Youth joins me, Shanna Sheehy, to talk about the upcoming Youth Summit in Anchorage. How do our youth-serving organizations impact your life? And what can they do to improve the quality of life for all kids in South Central Alaska? Call 1-888-583-7234, that's 888-KTD-RADIO, to ask Sarah Sledge a question or to comment during our conversation. Or send us a message at mail@kidsthesedays.org. That's Kids These Days coming up Tuesday, September 14th at 2 and 7 p.m. on KSKA. You're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. Today's featured guest is Dr. Patricia Kuhl, a leading researcher whose expertise is infant language acquisition. And I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. We'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Kuhl shortly. From Albania to Zuni, here in Alaska, languages abound, with 94 spoken in the Anchorage School District alone. And throughout the state, there are 20 indigenous languages spoken, many of which are in danger of dying out as older speakers pass away and English is increasingly spoken at school and at home. Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez recently spoke with Abby Augustine, a Yupik language teacher from Bethel, who's employing a fun and unique method of teaching Yupik to first and second graders. And she spoke with Doreen Brown, the supervisor of the Title VII Indian Education Program at the Anchorage School District, both about their efforts to preserve Alaska Native languages among school children.
Those of us who took high school French or Spanish might not remember much more than sitting in a classroom endlessly conjugating verb tenses or memorizing phrases for which we may have never encountered a context. Vamos a la discoteca, anyone? But what if second languages were taught much in the same manner in which we acquire first languages, through listening and associating actions or objects with words in the actual context in which they are used? That furry thing brother is calling to must be dog, and this white liquid that I'm offered every day must be milk. There is a teaching method that does exactly this, and it's called Total Physical Response Storytelling, or TPR storytelling for short, and it's being applied in classrooms to successfully teach children native Alaskan languages. Abby Augustine is a Yupik language education specialist for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. She trains teachers in teaching Yupik, but before she did this, she spent 13 years as a first and second grade teacher at a Yupik immersion school in Bethel, where she incorporated the TPR storytelling method into her classroom lessons.
Well, there's three basic steps that are followed in the TPR model. The first step being teachers demonstrating the demonstrating actions several times and give directions while waiting for the children to follow along. And then the second step being where you hesitate and pause to see if the children will follow the directions without you. Then if they don't do that, then you continue demonstrating. And then the last step being more like a test to see if they've made the connection with the words and meaning by not doing the action yourself and just giving the verbal directions. Then if they're not ready, then you continue repeating.
Total Physical Response was originally developed by James Asher, a professor of psychology at San Jose State University. It is based on the premise that children can best learn a second language according to the same code-breaking principles employed while learning their first language, that is, observing an action while hearing the word for that action.
Instead of just learning hungry, just as a word, I might use my hand and, you know, make a circular motion on my around my tummy area, and then, you know, they associate that me putting my making a circular motion around my tummy, and they know that I'm using the word hungry. So there's that association.
Augustine applied this method in her classroom through the use of storytelling, a tradition that is both well-established within the Yupik culture and also fun for young children because they get to move around and act like characters in a story.
I decided to try it in my classroom, and that was the year that I tried it. I had quite a successful year with my students, and then on top of it, we had fun doing it because many of these short stories have, you know, funny endings, and so it was so perfect. You know, we like to have humor in the Yupik culture, and that humor kind of lessened their stress level to use a language.
The children learn very short and humorous stories like this one about a wolf and a little bird. The wolf is hungry, and he sees a little bird. He approaches the little bird, and then the bird hands him a sandwich. The humor in a story like this one, instead of eating the bird as we'd expect, the wolf eats a sandwich, especially appeals to the kids, says Augustine.
So I have a gesture for the wolf, you know, making claws and a mean-looking face, and then I flap my hands like I'm a little bird. Una kadam jiguk gulunuk kailga sami gulunuk tangtuk gulunuk kaihtuk gulunuk tangtuk yaqul yaqamuk gulunram dulaga yaqul yaqak yaqul yaqam chikiga gulunuk sanu chamuk quyana guluk gulunuk tangtuk.
The children hear a story such as that one on Monday, both in English and then in Yupik, and act out motions to go along with the words. They practice and then act out the story at the end of the week for fellow classmates and also for their communities.
Sometimes we'd, you know, go to the senior center to perform for the elders, and of course the elders were always ever so delighted to see, you know, the students acting these short stories out with a little chuckle.
These new language skills aren't only for performance. Augustine says that she often overhears her students using them in the hallways at school.
In one of our stories, we had a story about the baby, you know, the baby crying. And my targets for that one story was the baby's crying, the baby is crying harder, Anyway, so there's a progression of the baby crying louder and louder. So anyway, I was walking to the nurse's office that week, beginning of the school year, and my students were, you know, conversing with each other, and then they were using, you know, those particular vocabulary, you know, about crying, you know, how they weren't going to cry when they, you know, got their shot from the nurse. And anyway, they were using the terms correctly, so I was, like, so delighted.
Ultimately, says Abby Augustine, she and her colleagues at the Lower Kuskokwim School District are striving to fulfill a common desire among their community that the children graduate from high school proficient in both English and in Yupik.
In summary, I just want to share that TPRS, having taught TPRS in the classroom, is one fun way classroom teachers can help reverse language loss.
Here in the Anchorage School District, students are learning a number of indigenous Alaska languages. Doreen Brown, the supervisor of the Title VII Indian Education Program, says that in addition to the K-6 Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, where Yupik is taught, the district is employing many different ways to teach language, from loaning out iPods stocked with stories and music to middle schoolers, to offering family language nights twice a week.
During the school day, we have two teachers. We have a Yupik instructor at the charter school, and we have a Tlingit teacher at East High School. And then in the evenings, we offer indigenous languages as well. In the past, we've offered four: Unangan, Tlingit, Dena'ina Athabascan, and Yupik.
Brown says that these evenings originally began at the request of the community for a place to gather and sew, practice dance, and to learn language. Now they offer arts and crafts, homework help, skill building, and open gym for both students and their family, providing a place for them to gather and a context in which to learn a language.
We like to look at it as kind of a family gathering, because, learning should never stop. So we have, you know, engaging the whole family that can participate. We've had adult carving or teen and adult carving. And so we try to make sure that it's open to everyone. And we also notice that some of our parents are not language speakers, native language speakers, so they're learning along with their children.
These evenings are open to the community, and they'll take place Tuesdays and Thursdays at Spring Hill Elementary from 6 to 8 p.m. beginning later this month. For more information about this program and a link to the Indian Education Program at the Anchorage School District, please visit our website at kidsthesedays.org, where you'll also find a language map of Alaska, photos of Abby Augustine with her students, and more information about her research on TPR storytelling. This is Sarah Gonzalez.
You're listening to Kids These Days. On Kids These Days, we're talking about raising Alaska's future today. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Well, we are so pleased to have Dr. Patricia Kuhl in the studio here with us today. We'll go back to the phones. We have a message from Paula.
Hi, I was calling to ask a question of Patricia Kuhl. I wanted to know what she thought were some of the best methods for raising a child to be bilingual. I am trying to raise my child to be bilingual and just wanted to know her insights. Thanks.
All right, that's another good question, very relevant in today's America, where we can begin to see the value of learning more than one language. So the first thing I can tell people is that because of this critical period that I've been describing, the first 7 years, that's the window of opportunity at which time the baby is and young child is going to absorb that language naturally. If exposed to it in a very natural way, in a social setting, not by DVDs and not by, you know, audio tapes, but really listening in a natural setting. And then secondly, that babies should be exposed to a native speaker. So if you know another language but you don't speak it very well, you're not going to be the best model for the baby. So you should pick a language that you can find a place and find a person and find a group that the infant can be in or the young child can play in a natural setting and listen to that second language. And then the third thing is to pick a language that you value as a family, because simply exposing the kids early, it will make a deep impression on their brains. But to maintain and grow a language, you have to keep using it. You have to be in settings in which, if you're learning, you know, French or Spanish or Japanese or Mandarin, a place where you can use it to grow that vocabulary, to grow that complicated syntax that the sounds, you know, build as you start to get exposed in more complex settings. I think if you do that and you follow that set of principles in the first 7 years, you'll have a child who speaks both languages. The other thing to recognize is that the research is showing that not only in adults, but in kids and even in babies, there's a cognitive advantage to being bilingual. The cognitive advantage isn't that you are smarter. It isn't an overall boost, but you're cognitively more flexible. You can present adults and children and even infants with problem-solving tasks. And the bilingual kids are faster and more accurate at inventing a new solution. We've got these clever little experiments in which we test babies, and they get used to grabbing a toy out of a plexiglass box from the front door. And they can see that the plexiglass is open in the front, and they'll grab that toy and they'll play it. Then if you shut the front door right in their sight, open the side door, and they have to invent the solution. Gee, I have to go in the side door to get the new toy. The bilingual kids are faster and they're more accurate at going and inventing the new solution. So
that's fascinating.
It's very interesting. And we think it's because the brain has had all this exercise in switching. Bilingual kids recognize that every object in the world has two names. And they have to decide in any given setting, well, does that person speak this language or that? So they're constantly toggling back and forth. And that toggling, that direction of attention, we think is quite good at creating flexibility. And so these kids and adults are more flexible.
Wow. You know, people talk a little bit about, like, for example, being fluent in music as being fluent in its own sort of language. Is that at all related to being fluent in two different languages or bilingual?
It's a good question. I mean, we don't know much about music. I think music is going to take the same path as language, meaning that you have some innate skills and then you're going to be shifting to one type of music or another, depending upon whether you're listening to Eastern or Western music, that you'll develop some skills related to that. So I don't know if music and language share that kind of, you know, a cognitive flexibility generation. But sign language does.
Oh,
so
really?
Natural sign language. So not Amaslan, that's a natural sign language invented by a deaf person, communicated to other deaf people. If you're a signer, whether it's your first language or your second language, you are cognitively flexible in the same way as you are if you know two oral languages. So language is language. And if it's really language, that switching between sign and oral, which a lot of hearing people do because they have a deaf sibling or a deaf parent, or they simply find it fascinating to sign as a part of their language history, they have that same cognitive benefit.
Wow. You know, in Alaska, we have indigenous groups that all have indigenous languages.
Right.
And in some cases, there's a lot of native speakers. And in other cases, there aren't very many native speakers. But there are, in many cases across the spectrum, people who are interested in resurrecting or perpetuating those languages.
Right.
With your research, would you have any advice for how those specific communities might be able to best ready children for learning that language, which, you know, may have had a gap for a few generations?
Well, we've got to encourage those few native speakers of those languages to talk to the kids. I mean, language is a living thing, and the only way to preserve it is to biologically instill it in the next new generation. And all of the work is suggesting, as I've been saying, that you need to do that early. So the best thing to do to preserve that history and that language so it doesn't die, and it will. It will literally die if you don't teach it to the young. That the senior members of the culture who can speak that language fluently should interact with the children at very young ages so that they learn a love for that language. They master it. But two, they learn songs and stories and tales that they love to tell using the vocabulary of that language, which is going to be unique to coding the ideas that language does the best at coding. That's the way to preserve it, and there really isn't a better way.
Well, I'd like to remind you, you're listening to Kids These Days. We're in the studio with Dr. Patricia Kuhl today, and she's answering listeners' questions. You can call 1-888-KTD-RADIO. That is 1-888-KTD, like Kids These Days, and then radio. And you can call and leave a comment or question at this time. And I think, Dr. Kuhl, we have time enough for one last question. So we have, it's a two-part question that came in from a listener named Catherine, who lives in Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Catherine Sullivan. I have two children, now 13 and 11, through international adoption. I'd like to ask Dr. Kuhl to explain about the changes in the brains of children exposed to their birth language for their first 12 to 24 months and then learning the language in their new home. If these children don't have exposure to their birth language, would they still have the capacity to discriminate the phonetic contrast learning of their birth language? That's my first question. My second question is, I'd like to ask Dr. Kuhl about the progress on a way to measure infants' phonetic and social speech processing abilities as markers for autism spectrum disorder. When caregivers are assessing the speech, language, and social abilities of their or of others' infants, what would alert them that their infant is not typically developing? Thank you very much.
Oh, those are both great questions. So let's start with the first one. So as I've been talking, there are big changes that happen before the end of the first year. So when you're adopting a child from another culture, that child's been exposed. You said 12 to 24 months. So that child's already had quite a bit of experience listening to that first language. And then coming to a country in which faces look different and the voices sound different and that language is really different. So I saw one child who was adopted from China at 14 months. And I saw this child because the mother was so concerned. She said that when she brought the child to the United States at 14 months, the baby became suddenly silent, simply staring at her face, but not uttering a word. She didn't hear any of the Chinese that she had heard before adoption, and there wasn't any babbling going on, and she was really frightened. And I said, give it time. Imagine what that baby's trying to do. The baby has been hearing Chinese, which sounds so very different with the tonal contrast, and just wait. And sure enough, within a couple of months, maybe two, three, that child started making noises, and the noises were very, very American English sounding, and she started to babble and then rapidly went through all of the transitions and started using English words. So will that baby preserve Mandarin Chinese? I think it's there. And I think if the parents value the child keeping that language, you have to keep that child exposed and keep that language alive in the child. I think if the child never heard that language until they were 20, I still think they'd be a step up from a child who at 20 tried to master Mandarin and had never been exposed. I think it's that deep and impressionable when you hear it early. But if you do value keeping that second language, you ought to spend a little time trying to make sure that this young child has the opportunity to keep the first language alive in their little minds. So that was your first one. The second one has to do with autism. And we're making huge progress on tests of autism that incorporate the ideas that we've been talking about here today. We were saying that the baby brain is computational, but that the social piece is what turns the computational brain on. We believe that the attraction to language, so the social attraction, is essential to language learning. That's why the DVD doesn't work. That's why you can't learn a foreign language from a television set if you're a baby. You need that social interaction. Children with autism dislike. They seem to be fearful of social interaction. So we have a test now that's, we believe we might have a biomarker for autism. And that is this listening test, which also has a brain correlate, this listening test that will allow a child to choose between mothery snippets and the non-speech analogs of those, the computer warble as a snippet. And we give them eight different instances of each, and they can choose them at will. And this little listening test can be done as early as 15 weeks. And we're now testing siblings of children with autism at 6 months. And we believe that our test will identify the 30% or so of the siblings of children in families where an older child has been diagnosed with autism. We believe our test will predict which kids will be diagnosed in the next 2 years. Now, the value of that is that we believe our research will lead us to very clever interventions for children with autism. And if we could start those interventions really early, much earlier than is now the case, because now autism is diagnosed at the age of three. If you could diagnose at 6 months or, you know, right in that first year when the brain is so plastic and you'd enveloped that child in the kinds of interventions that they're intrigued by. There are many things they're intrigued by, but just not such a human-looking face and not this wonderful, embellished motheries. They do not like that signal. So we may be able to develop ways and means to get them attracted to encourage that brain to learn language during the critical period rather than not. And that would make such a difference in these lives of the children who are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. So we're in progress on that work, and we'll let everybody know when we know what the answer is.
And that's research that you're doing currently in your lab.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just clarify, you used the term biomarker. I just want to make sure I understand what that means.
A biomarker is just a way of indicating that you'd have an early indicator of a child who is at risk for autism. And we've got two indicators. One is this behavioral choice test. That's just a listening test. And the other is a brain measure that correlates strongly with the behavioral measure, and it's how the brain responds to the difference between speech sounds. The brain is not responding in the same way in kids who do not like to listen to a motheries signal. So these are two markers that we think will predict way ahead of time which are the children who you could think about looking at very carefully with regard to interventions. Parents can be aware of children's tendency to want to look at them. One of the symptoms of autism is not to seek eye gaze. Typically developing children are just so fascinated by your face and by your voice. Children with autism would much rather play with objects than people. They'd much rather listen to the sounds that objects make rather than language. And so if you had a child who had those symptoms, it would be best to try to seek help through a university clinic or through a medical practitioner who had the expertise to guide you with regard to your child.
And as you learn more, when might some of your findings be available for people to find out more?
We're probably a year out from actually knowing and being ready to announce to the public that we do have a test that's going to be providing this kind of advance information. In scientific time, that's not very long. It's a year. That's very exciting to us that we could be that close.
Well, we'll definitely link to your organizations through our website at kidsthesedays.org.
That'd be great.
And Dr. Cool, I want to thank you so much for coming in and spending your time with us today on Kids These Days. It truly has been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Patricia Cool is the co-director for iLabs at the University of Washington. That's the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. She's internationally renowned for her work with early learning, brain development, and language acquisition. You can find links and more information about her online at our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. Thank you for joining us for Kids These Days. We're on each week right here on this listener-supported station. Take part in the conversation anytime online at kidsthesedays.org or by calling our message line at 1-888-583-7234. That's easy to remember because it spells KTD Radio. You heard from Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez and Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran today. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Join us again next week.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the host, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on this program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.